morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most vital segment of our society, to those of you like me who know that there's something troubling, even destructive, about the institutions which control our society, our nations, and the world. Whether they be religious or political, media or military, even economic, we realize that these massive and maniacal contrivances are the problem. They are not the solution. So instead of trying to rearrange the color of the deck chairs on our sinking Titanic of state, our mission is to scour the news, looking behind the headlines, so that we understand who is causing the tragedies that are besieging our planet and why they're doing so, all while predicting how these events will influence our world. Then in our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His guidance regarding His covenant provides the only glimmer of hope. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion at any time over the next 2 hours, is 877-300-7645. Let's begin with the government's takeover of the health care agenda. To set this into context, back in 1965, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who many assume had a role in the killing of JFK, so that he, a man with a highly checkered past in Texas, could gain control of the White House and implement his brave new world. He succeeded in radically changing U.S. governance. Previously, America had been based upon free enterprise principles and upon individual accountability and responsibility. He changed all that. His idea was to have a safety net that would provide welfare and health care for anyone, not based upon their need, but their desire. It was at that time that the program known today as Medicare was conceived. It was announced at the time that it would never cost the American taxpayer more than 1% of the total budget of the federal government. Well, now, since that time, this Ponzi scheme, and it is a Ponzi scheme because it is, though the benefits that are being paid are being contributed by the newest participants in the scheme. And so those who are receiving the benefits did not pay for them. There is no trust fund. There is no investment. This is not like an insurance company. This is simply a Ponzi scheme. But that Ponzi scheme now is the largest part of the U.S. government. It has grown from nothing in 1965 to the point now where it is about 38% of total government spending. It's one of three programs that collectively represent about 80% of the federal budget. The Ponzi scheme of Social Security comes in second, and of course, the military comes in third. As it relates to health care and the program called Medicaid and Medicare, Medicaid is the program for those who are under 65, who are unable or unwilling to pay for their own health care. And Medicare is the program for those who are over 65 that the government wishes to intervene and cover the cost of what typically is 80% of a person's health care needs, which is in the last years of their life. Well, that program, between Medicaid and Medicare, have not just grown from nothing in 1965 to the largest aspect of U.S. federal spending, that is the principal aspect that is bankrupting the nation along with Social Security. But it is also the fastest growing. aspect of government spending. And so Obama decided that that wasn't harmful enough. Here's a nation that is $17 trillion in debt, that is in debt at a greater, at a rate greater than 100% of its gross domestic product, and that he decided that the problem wasn't the fact that Medicare and Medicaid were the fastest growing aspect of U.S. spending, or that they were the largest aspect of government spending, but the problem was that we weren't spending enough. So he proposed what on the surface was going to be a 30% increase to the Medicaid aspect of Medicare. And then began to promote it as a universal solution for Americans and labeled it by the misnomer, the Affordable Care Act. When in fact, those who actually can and do pay for their own health care coverage have had to radically reduce their coverage because coverage that was somewhat universal was considered to be a burden on the overall economy and a luxury that needed to be taxed. And so anyone that was responsible in covering all of their health care needs no longer does so. And the premiums that are paid now by individuals who are responsible for covering their own health care are hugely increased, some as much as now 30% over what they were previously paying for an inferior product. This is called the Affordable Care Act, all to make health care free for those who don't choose to actually pay for their own. Well, so this president then, institute this new plan, conceived all manner of new taxes. There are some 14 new taxations that are part of his plan. He is even taxing things like artificial knees and hips. The apparati that are designed bear a special tax. There's a special tax on doctors, for example. And the affordable nature of the plan simply says that we're going to pay hospitals and doctors less than we currently pay them, which is already at a rate that is bankrupting both, and that that would be the manner of savings, which means they'll simply transfer the costs to those who are actually paying for their services. Well, they continued with this scheme, which is destined to accelerate the bankruptcy of the United States. To the point they decided that, yes, the government should design its own website. Now, this is the same country that engages in war and typically kills more of its own than that enemy manages to kill. This is the same government that runs the U.S. Post Office. This is the same government that's responsible for the shoddy repair of America's infrastructure, its roads, its electrical grid, its sewer and water systems. Well, they were not up to the task. That this consortium of programmers, which the government did attempt to spec out, but spec out from government contractors as opposed to genuine free enterprise based programming firms. Well, they have now found that, well, according to the New York Times, there's 5 million lines of code that have to be rewritten. You know, I designed a internet company. I didn't do it alone. I hired what I consider to be the best and the brightest in their various areas, and collectively, we created what was at the time the ultimate marketplace for products and ideas. And I can tell you that if you're in a position where you need to rewrite 5 million lines of code, you'd be vastly better off scrapping everything you have done and starting over. It all really begins with a proper coordination where you can articulate in writing specifically what the end product is supposed to do. And then you give it that flow of, this is exactly what I have to offer. This is the clients that this product needs to interact with, and this is precisely what it needs to do for each of those participating in this site, and then you turn it over to be developed. Well, the U.S. government is incapable of doing those things. And when you reach the point where you have 5 million lines of code that have to be written, rewritten, you need to start all over again. Or perhaps, if we were wise, scrap the entire scheme. The Washington Post reported on Monday that the website's inability to handle traffic was a known problem. That just days before the plan launch, when they had as few as 100 people beta testing the website, it crashed. It couldn't handle a few hundred people. You know, again, having spent my previous life in business, having built an internet retail operation, I can tell you that you don't even consider launching something until you have thoroughly tested it. And you have put it under considerable strain. And you've done everything you can to foil its intent. And you have an entire team of people devoted to debugging it and to testing it, but not the U.S. government. It's just not that smart. It strikes me as funny, though, that with as many conspiracy nuts as there are out there that think, for example, that the United States government planned 9/11 and perpetrated it, not Muslims hijacking our planes and flying them as suicide bombers into those targets, a plan conceived by Ramzi Youssef, that the U.S. government secretly conspired to destroy our buildings. And this is the very government that can't even build a website. The Post also reported that a group of 10 insurers that were invited to give advice and test the website urged the federal officials not to do a launch of it because they said there were far too many bugs in it and too many challenges that had yet to be resolved. And yet a week before the launch date, even after the insurers themselves said, don't launch this, it's not ready, the U.S. government ignored them, and the administration went forward with their plan. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Come back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about the myth of universal health care and the government supplying it. One of the things that is not covered in the news, but if you were to talk to the head of most of the largest healthcare insurance providers, the Blue Cross, Blue Shields, and the like, what they would all tell you privately, but not publicly, is that the Affordable Care Act has made it essentially impossible for them to prosper in the free enterprise system providing healthcare insurance. And that all of them recognize that they need to take their relationship with millions of customers and their financial capabilities and technological capabilities into other businesses, divesting themselves of healthcare because the government, through this Affordable Care Act, have made it impossible to prevail as a healthcare provider, as a private business. And that's the government's intent. If you can drive the private supplier, the free enterprise supplier, out of business, no matter how horrible the government's solution might be in terms of the quality of the medical support and the aggravation of having to stand in long lines and be treated poorly, no matter how bad the situation is, if you have no alternative because there is no private source of health care coverage, you'll be forced to go along. And that really is the future. So here's the AP. They talked to a number of the developers, all of which come from one of three different firms, none of which are among the players that any business would hire. You know, as a business, if you wanted to develop a infrastructure, a technological infrastructure, you know, you're going to call one of the big accounting firms, all of which specialize in this, or one of the big technology companies. Doesn't matter if it's Dell or IBM or Hewlett-Packard or Ernst & Young or PricewaterhouseCoopers, whether they're an accounting firm or a technology firm, their primary source of income now is providing technological assistance, programming to companies that have massive requirements. And yet that is not whom the government contacted. And if you were to do this, you might even work with a company like Oracle, because this is the manipulation of vast array of data that's stored in databases. But no, not the U.S. government. No, they went to CGI Federal Inc., which is a company that exists to provide programming for the federal government, a Maryland-based Quality Software Services Inc., and of course the always greedy Booz Allen Hamilton. Booz Allen, if you'll recall, is the company that provided Edward Snowden, and it's the company that tried to hire my son to work on the nuclear reactors on aircraft carriers for the U.S. Navy. They create this buffer which enables the federal government to benefit from individuals while not actually employing them and giving them any of the rights and protections that they demand of business. That's the group that was hired to do this, and they have thus far cost the U.S. government $400 million for nothing, for something that needs to be started all over again. It is a tragedy. It is an example of why big government doesn't work. It's why we ought not depend on government. But this is just the beginning of this problem. It is so vastly greater, because the growing size of the federal bite out of the healthcare business, that sector, is growing so rapidly in a nation that is $17 trillion in debt and growing more in debt each day. It is a calamity that cannot be avoided, a train wreck now that is certain. And by passing and funding the Affordable Care Act, all we have done is exacerbate our own demise. We were talking yesterday in the middle of a discussion, which will probably go through today and into tomorrow, about the myths associated with global warming and how anthropogenic models showing the Earth warming as a result of man spewing carbon dioxide into the air, and therefore all of the calamities that needed to be avoided because of such are the matter of myth, not scientific fact or truth. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Our number, if you'd like to join in this discussion on global warming, is 877-300-7645. As we were considering yesterday, in its last report in 2007, the international assemblage of scientists staffing what is the climate change committees have stated that the global warming and the climate system and the warming, if I were to quote them precisely, the warming of the climate system is unequivocal. That's their 2007 report. And yet, from 1998 to 2013, covering the 9 years prior to that unequivocal warming of the climate, and 5 years thereafter, or 6 years thereafter, what we have found is that climate system is not warming. In fact, in the last 2 years, it has been cooling. So their statement that was unequivocal was completely wrong in 2007. They won a Nobel Prize for that statement in 2007, and it was wrong in here now in 2013, rather than admit we were wrong. No, they just doubled down and said, believe us. They also said in 2007 that most of the observed increase in the global average temperature since the mid-20th century was very likely due to the observed increase in anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations. In other words, to humans burning fossil fuels. Anthropogenic is a compound of three Greek words. The word for man, the word concerning, and the word for genesis or the creation. And yet here's a system that is vast. It's universal on its scale. It's not just global. It's universal on its scale. And we have ability to track history going back through archaeology millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. And we find that there are periods of times when there was no global ice whatsoever on the planet. No ice packs anywhere. There are no polar ice packs. We can go back in time on the planet. In fact, 80% of the time on the planet, there was no Arctic ice pack. 80% of the time. We can go back through time and we find lots of periods of warming and cooling. We also can study the nature of our planet and find that less than 0.01% of the carbon dioxide that exists in the atmosphere, the atmosphere carbon dioxide in total, represents less than 0.01% of the total carbon dioxide found in the oceans and rocks and minerals and plant materials. In fact, carbon dioxide is not a poison. It's food for plants. It's what plants ingest to grow, to be green. It is absurd to make man the center of the universe, as this does. It's a religious edict based on socialist secular humanism, where man is the center of all. And that is exactly what anthropogenic means. This conjecture enriched the climatologists, of course. They all became fabulously rich and empowered as a result of this statement. It also enriched and empowered liberal politicians the world over. At the same time, it impoverished the masses, transferring wealth while constraining economic growth. You pay more in your electric bill. You pay more for the fuel in your car. You have less employment opportunities. You have more government control because of this lie. In the latest draft summary seen by the BBC, the level of scientific certainty has increased. So as the data, the facts have shown that their conclusions in 2007 were absolutely wrong, they claim now that their certainty, scientific certainty, has actually increased. Now, all that reveals is that climate science has become like religion. It's faith-based, not fact-based. The panel that states that it's 95% certain that human influence on climate caused more than half of the observed global increase in average surface temperatures from 1951 to 2010. Actually, there's no indication whatsoever that human influence changed the climate one iota, nor is there any indication that surface temperatures have increased over the last 60 years. None. You know, since 2007, there has been a growing focus, the article says, on the fact that the global average temperatures haven't gone above the level recorded in 1998. As a matter of fact, for 14 of those years, they were static. And the last 2 years, they have actually decreased. As I said, this summer, where the climatologists had predicted that the Arctic would be ice-free, the ice pack actually covered 60% greater area than it had previously. Now, this article says this slowdown, it's not a slowdown. Then they use the term hiatus in the IPCC, as they refer to it, has been leapt upon by climate skeptics to argue that the scientific belief that emitting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increases the temperature of the planet is wrong. The climatologists themselves, prior to the 15-year hiatus, as they call it, said that if we were to go 10 to 15 years without any discernible increase in temperature, it would demonstrate that their models were wrong. That occurred, and yet they changed their criterion for what would demonstrate their models are wrong. Scientists have attempted to explain the pause in a number of ways, with many arguing that the Earth has continued to warm, but that the heat has gone into the oceans. Now, the only problem with that is that the oceans are now cooler. The most recent reports suggested that the periodic cooling of the Pacific Ocean was a counteracting influence on the extra carbon in the atmosphere. In other words, the data is 100% contradictory to their excuse. The article even says, but there is no certainty and little agreement among scientists on the mechanisms that are involved. This is a quote from Professor Peterson, who is one of those who profits from the myth of global warming. He said, I wouldn't say that there is a reluctance of the authors to take up such an issue as the pause, but they want to do it in the proper way. There will remain a tension between how much you can deliver based upon peer-reviewed science and what governments would like to have, end quote. Let me interpret his words for you. I'm going to lie to you because it will protect my industry, which is climate science. And I'm going to tell you that you can't publish a peer-reviewed document that explains why there is no global warming, because the peer review process won't allow it. Governments are desirous of having proof of global warming so that they can tax people more, and so that they can be more invasive in people's lives. That's what they want, but you can't get that through the process because the facts don't support it. The draft report, the panels, is shown in agreement that the rate of warming over the past 15 years is smaller than the trend since 1951. No, it's not. The rate of warming isn't smaller. Over the past 15 to 16 years, we've cooled. That's the opposite of warming. Actually, between 1951 and 1980, the prevalence of sophistication and the sophistication of measuring equipment was woefully inadequate, and most of the data has been lost or actually destroyed, as is the case with, conflicting religious texts. If the data doesn't suit their agenda, it's destroyed. And if the data doesn't suit their agenda, they'll say the instrumentation is flawed. When the data seems to support their conclusions, they say the instrumentation is fine. The fact of the matter is, it wasn't until quite recently that we got thousands of measuring stations, all with live satellite uplinks that can provide real-time temperatures around the globe. So it's about the last 15 years or so that we've had the capacity actually to study whether or not the Earth is warming. And what we have found is that it is, in fact, cooling. Many skeptical voices believe this is a recognition that the IPCC's modeling process has been too sensitive to carbon dioxide. And they've focused on carbon dioxide because it is the result of industry. Now, this claim is given some credence by the text of a draft which states that models have been too strong a response to the increasing greenhouse gas forcing. In other words, they know that CO2 in the atmosphere is not a poison, that it has always been there, that the amount in the atmosphere is insignificant in amount compared to the amount in the oceans and in plants and in even rocks and minerals. But Professor Jean Pascal Van Yersele, who is the vice chair of the IPCC, rejects this idea. To take that out of context, if that change is confirmed this week, and to prevent it as a big change in the opinion of the IPCC and what it claims is true about climate sensitivity is ridiculous. In other words, if you quote their own internal text, you're being ridiculous. Most climate scientists wouldn't say that the 15-year period is a good reason to question the overall quality of the models. And yet, prior to this, in their own stated and publicly produced documentation, they said if there was a 15-year hiatus in global warming, it would prove that their models were invalid. The language has become more complicated to understand, but it is more precise. Even the journalist who wrote this article for the BBC said, it is virtually unreadable. That is what they have produced. Welcome back to Shattering Myths and our review of the myth of global warming. I'm going to share now an article that speaks a bit of what was called ClimateGate, where the global warming, which is called the anthropogenic global warming myth, the website of those who are employed to promote the myth was hacked. They hacked the CRU website and they released 61 megabytes of confidential files onto the internet. And if you read those files, which contain some 1,000 emails, 72 other documents, you realize why the staffers at the Climate Research Institute wanted them to stay confidential. As Andrew Volt puts it, this scandal could well be the greatest in modern science. These emails exchanged by some of the most prominent scientists pushing the anthropogenic global warming myth suggest that they are involved in a conspiracy, a collusion relative to exaggerating the warming data, illegal destruction of embarrassing or contrary information, and organized resistance to disclosure and a manipulation of the data, as well as private admissions of the flaws in their public claims. Concerning the way that the global warming advocates have manipulated and suppressed the evidence in order to support their cause, here are some examples. I'll be quoting from the information that was released onto the public. One wrote, and these are the top scientists for the center. I've just completed Mike's nature trick of adding in different temperatures to each series for the last 20 years to hide the decline that was revealed by Keith. The fact that we can't account for the lack of warming at the moment is a travesty. That the CERES data published in the August Brahms 09 supplement on 2008 shows that there should be even more warming, but the data must be wrong. Our observing systems must be inadequate. So when the data doesn't show warming, it's the system's fault that the data is bad and the systems are inadequate. When they show warming, which is only in a period where the infrastructure and the systems were much less adequate, they're reliable. So the opposite of what logic would tell you, which is that the last 15 or 16 years when we've had the satellite uplink of real-time temperature data from sites around the world, thousands of them, and they're showing cooling, that data is unreliable, and those reporting stations are unreliable. And yet, prior to this time, when we didn't have this capability, that data is considered reliable, and those technical systems are considered appropriate. The opposite of what is true. Another quote, can you delete any of your emails that you've had with Keith regarding his AR4? Keith will do likewise. Can you also email Gene and have him get to do the same? And we'll be getting Casper to do likewise. In other words, they had a discussion between them, which showed that the data was inconsistent with the global warming theory. And so they simply misrepresented the data to support the theory. Now they wanted all of the email correspondence as to what they had done wiped from their email logs. Another quote. Next time I see Pat Michaels, who is one of the those who is correctly presenting the reality that there is no such thing as global warming, he says, next time I see Pat Michaels at a scientific meeting, I'll be tempted to beat the crap out of him, end quote. There's also an inconvenient truth regarding the medieval warming period that they're attempting to hide. Here's a quote on that. Phil and I have recently submitted a paper using about a dozen NH records that fit this category, many of which are available nearly 2,000 back. I think that we're trying to attempt a time frame of 2K rather than the usual 1,000 years addresses a good point that was raised by Peck in an earlier memo, that it would be nice to try to contain the punitive MWP. The MWP is the medieval warm period. Even if we don't yet have a hemispheric mean reconstruction available for that far back. In other words, they're trying to say that the Earth's temperatures have been consistently warming, when in fact in the medieval period they were much warmer than they are today. And that this is simply part of a greater cycle. And to prevent people from realizing that, they're looking for ways to conceal the truth. We'll be back in a second.